Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, investigative journalist Will Potter, has been reporting on protest movements for more than 25 years. In 2011, he wrote the book Green is the New Red. It revealed how governments and corporations labeled nonviolent activists terrorists. His new book, Little Red Barns, Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable, is the result of a 10-year investigation about factory farms and rising fascism. He writes about ag-gag laws, which classify factory farm investigations as an act of domestic terrorism, the powerful forces working to obscure reality and suppress protest, and animal agriculture's role in accelerating climate collapse. Here are just a few facts in the book, Little Red Barns. Nearly 10 billion animals are raised, transported, and slaughtered every single year just in the United States without any meaningful government regulation or oversight of how farm animals are treated. Animal agriculture has become the largest land use system on Earth. Livestock use 83% of global farmland. As global meat demand soars, animal agriculture companies must claim more and more land. And to do that, meat companies expand further into low-income areas domestically. They also expand abroad, forcing indigenous peoples from their ancestral lands. And then on climate, Will Potter writes that it's difficult to write about animal agriculture and climate change, not because there's conflicting evidence or too little of it, but rather because there's so much, it's hard to stay on top of it all. The evidence is strikingly clear. Animal agriculture is one of the most environmentally destructive industries on the planet and a leading contributor to climate change. Will Potter is an award-winning investigative journalist and TED Senior Fellow who exposes political repression and the erosion of civil liberties. His latest book is Little Red Barns, Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable. Hi, Will. Congratulations on your book. Thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rose. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, it's great to have you back, Will. As I said, you've been reporting on protest movements for more than 25 years. And I want to ask you about a piece that broke on NBC News yesterday. Four reporters write that White House officials have held increasingly serious discussions in recent days about Trump invoking the Insurrection Act, a rarely used 19th century law that gives the president the power to deploy active duty troops inside the United States for law enforcement purposes. And they write that this decision is not expected to be imminent, according to senior officials. Were it to happen, it would be a notable escalation because the Guard is currently deployed in cities across the country. They've become increasingly aggressive in Chicago. I'm not sure if people have seen what happened at the South Shore apartment that was raided, but if you didn't, you should definitely look at what happened there. So what are your thoughts on this, Will?
Yeah, that's something I'm monitoring really closely. I think like a lot of us are that pay attention to this rise of fascism right now. I think a couple of years ago, I might think that that would be a bridge too far, but now we've already seen the intentions and the groundwork being laid for this. The incursions into major U.S. cities, sending the troops, is really setting up a showdown over federal power and an opposition to state rights, especially with democratic cities and democratic-led states. So I think this is entirely within the realm of possibility because, as you said, Rose, we can see this escalating day by day in just an absolutely chilling way. Some of the footage from Portland and Chicago, I mean, we have clergy members being shot with rubber bullets, people snatched off the street, violence against elected officials and people who are running for elected office. I mean, this is beyond the pale of, I think, what a lot of us could have envisioned even a few years ago.
And for people who are not following all of this, because it's just so hard to keep up, I just want to give people a couple of the details. So you talked about that pastor. This is from The Hill today. Department of Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin defended an ICE officer who shot a pastor with a pepper ball from a rooftop after a video of the incident went viral this week. It happened September 19th. It circulated widely on Wednesday. It showed the Reverend David Black of the First Presbyterian Church being struck in the head by an officer outside an ICE processing facility in a Chicago suburb. And then the incident in Chicago at the apartment building was just horrific. I'm reading from CNN. Adults and children alike were pulled from their Chicago apartments, crying and screaming during a large overnight raid that has left tenants and neighbors shaken. Daryl Ballard, who lives next door, said, "I've been on a military base for a good portion of my life, and the activity I saw, it was an invasion." This led to the arrest of 37 undocumented immigrants, most from Venezuela, some from Mexico, Nigeria, and Colombia. This is according to the Department of Homeland Security. And this is the one thing that really got people talking, Will. There was a Black Hawk helicopter flying over this five-story building in the South Shore neighborhood, and then military-sized vehicles and agents filled the parking lot, which just frightened people.
Well, and I think you're zooming in on the heart of the danger here is this blurring and erasing of the line between domestic and foreign operations. And it's important to remember why we have those barriers in place. For instance, I write a lot about the FBI and domestic surveillance, and the FBI is ostensibly, at least, restrained more than our CIA operations, for instance, operating overseas. And the idea is that there's a heightened restriction because of American citizens and operating on U.S. soil. And so we're seeing this being erased, not just in the militarization of U.S. cities and things like munitions and Black Hawk helicopters being deployed, but I'm also seeing it in the rhetoric of people like Kristi Noem. Just the other day, she was making statements that were both completely nonsensical about the girlfriend of an Antifa founder, which doesn't exist, but, you know, making these press conferences about statements like that, while at the same time comparing anti-fascists to MS-13. And to me, this is signaling kind of where this is going right now. It is what scholars of fascism would call a dual state. It's splitting the legal system in two so that if you get a designation like this, either by being an immigrant or anti-fascist or some other category of undesirable to the administration, you're set apart in a separate legal system with separate standards where the normal rules just don't apply. And unfortunately, that's the era that we're entering right now. And this is really escalating at a radical pace.
There's another piece of news that we should talk about. Mark Bray is an anti-fascist scholar. And we had him on our show talking about his book about Antifa. And he has moved to Europe because of threats to his life. I'm reading now from The Guardian. Mark Bray says threats intensified after a Turning Point USA petition accused him of promoting political violence. So Mark Bray is temporarily relocating to Europe as he grapples with threats that intensified after a student group affiliated with the organization founded by murdered conservative activist Charlie Kirk accused him of being a, quote, prominent leader of the Antifa movement on campus. And what's so scary about this, I don't have any more details, but Mark Bray on Blue Sky said he and his family were getting ready to go to Europe, and they found out en route that their plane tickets had been canceled. So can you talk about this? I mean, it's so chilling, frightening, whatever word you want to use, to think that a Rutgers historian, Mark Bray, has received so many death threats that he's moving his family to Europe because of Turning Point USA.
And unfortunately, I think this is a reality that a lot of those of us who are journalists and scholars working in this space are wrestling with right now. Mark isn't the only one who's felt that he's needed to leave the country. You know, in recent months, we've had prominent scholars at Yale and other institutions feeling like they need to leave, scholars of fascism. And I think the danger here just if it's not abundantly clear to listeners, is this catch-all phrase of Antifa or anti-fascist is now the new boogeyman. I was speaking on Democracy Now! Recently about the designation of anti-fascist as a terrorist threat. And if you look at that language and the national security memorandum that was issued, it's not about, you know, it invokes language of violence, but it's really talking about funding, about ideology, and about disrupting networks that they're describing in these truly chilling terms of like infecting and being a plague in the United States. They're trying to eradicate the left. So with the situation with Mark, what's really disturbing to me is it's hard to know what the new standard is. It's hard to know if it's time for some of us to be leaving, or if these are kind of spectacles and displays of power to instill fear. And I think both of those are possible, but what's clear is that this is ramping up and we're reaching a point where I think we need to have serious discussions of people that might be disappeared off the street because of their public advocacy, especially with this language of MS-13 and foreign terrorist groups, where people could be sent if they're designated in this way.
And I think what's so scary, Will, is that this country is so armed. I mean, it'd be one thing to take chances and speak out, speak your truth without guns in this country. But the fact is, 327 people are shot every day in this country. I wish this got more media attention. We've done a couple of shows about this in the last few weeks because of the horrific shootings that have happened. But that's the other problem here. Is that it's so easy to get a gun and it's so easy to bring a gun to a public place or in Mark Bray's case, into a classroom.
Oof, that really hits home. And I've been wrestling with this quite a bit on a personal level. I mean, with the new book coming out, being on book tour, I did an event at Powell's in Portland with Abby Martin right after Charlie Kirk was killed. Mm-hmm. And both of us have had long histories of death threats and being targeted by the far right and some of these folks. And the thought process that emerges is really destabilizing and disorienting because, you have to worry about these things in general, being kind of a public figure and not being a public figure, right? Just going to the movie theater or the grocery store, we're seeing shootings in all of these public places. But now we're adding in this element of heightened political violence and also this being, I have to say it, this is being egged on and encouraged, not even as a dog whistle, but openly by the administration, by Kristi Noem, by Pam Bondi, by Trump, the Trump brothers. I mean, they're framing this as a culture war and kind of cheering on the retaliatory violence in the name of Charlie Kirk, in the name of cracking down on anti-fascist. And it's hard to know how to respond to that because the threat is real.
Well, that's the question, is how to respond to this. I mean, you have gone into some of the most horrific situations with factory farms, and you write that you've spent most of your life bearing witness to humanity at its worst, and in doing so, you've placed yourself in positions where you've been able to witness humanity at its best. Even in the most bleak stories of injustice and loss, you write that you've seen bone-chilling heroism, empathy, and grace. But this is where people are really grappling, Will, is how do you respond to this? Because, historians say that once you lose your rights, it's really hard to get them back.
Very much. And I'm feeling that tension daily. You know, and I kind of had a crisis of faith, for lack of a better description, in working on this book about factory farms and fascism, because I'd always placed this unwavering faith in this idea of bearing witness, that I don't know how to solve these systemic injustices and systems of oppression, but I've had this faith that as a journalist, if I tell the story and do the investigation and follow, the best practices of my craft, it will get the story out. And that's at least a first step in confronting darkness, is making this information available. The crisis I've had in the dilemma is it feels more and more that facts just don't matter, that journalism and truth is not just being disregarded, but is seen as the opposition or as the enemy. with the attacks on the press. Where I've kind of resulted after this very long investigation and now seeing outright fascism rise in the US is kind of somewhere in between. I've kept this faith in bearing witness because I do think it is this fundamental act of confronting darkness. I don't know where we begin if it's not in speaking truth to power and testifying about what we've seen. But increasingly, I'm starting to feel on a personal level, and at these book events, I'm hearing it from people, like you said, Rose, like we're all in the same place. We don't know what to do. It's an overwhelming amount of dark and horrific information. And I think we're all kind of entering this freeze response, like a trauma response of not quite sure how we act. And so I've returned to bearing witness in a way as an act of kind of spiritual defiance that I don't know if it will lead to the changes that we need to see happen. But I refuse to do anything else as an act of just maintaining my own humanity. And I don't know if that's necessarily the way forward for all of us, but I think it does open up some possibilities of how we think about moving through the world, of kind of releasing ourselves a little bit from some of the outcomes and instead doing and living our lives in a way that we can be proud of, whether or not we're able to fully beat back this fascist threat right now.
I think your words are so important. You write, by bearing witness, we take in shared pain and trauma, but through that act, somehow miraculously, more space opens up within us, and it is love, rage, and courage that flows into it. Perhaps we should view truth-telling in these times less about us and more about witnessing for future generations. I mean, when you think about it, Will, we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court tomorrow, and we're going to see, even if we have, good environmental laws, say in 10 years, the conservatives on the court will just overturn them. And so this is going to be with us, those of us, depending on our age, for a couple decades to come at least. And so I think, I have a 15-year-old niece, and I wonder what's in store for her future. And I thought about her and all of the children when you write about, bearing witness for future generations. It's so important.
Well, and I'm kind of obsessed in the same line of thinking because we don't, it's hard to see any meaningful progress in these next years, as you've said. I mean, it's going to be an all-out defensive fight or straight-up civil war, I think, is where we're heading. But at the same time, we're seeing the rise of the ecological crisis and breaking through key indicators of planetary health one after another, not just climate change and global warming, but species lost, extinction, deforestation, water. And as these crises grow, I argue in Little Red Barns that it's going to intersect with this rising authoritarianism. These problems are going to fuel each other. So, and I know that's a lot to put out there because it is so overwhelming and dark to think about. But in some ways, I think we have to take that long or longer view of resistance. And I think we have to keep front and center your teenage niece and people that are younger than us and that are coming up so that even if we can't fix this for them, no matter how hard we fight, we're setting them up knowing that they're going to come looking for answers. I don't know about you, Rose, but I'm doing that a lot right now. I'm reading Hannah Arendt. I'm reading journalists from World War II. I'm looking at anti-fascists in Spain. I've done this my whole career of kind of turning to those past stories and looking for some notes of advice or inspiration or guidance or even just like camaraderie of feeling less alone. And I think we have to think of ourselves that way. You know, it's easier to look at people historically and hold them up as heroes, but we need to start looking at ourselves this way because that's what we're going to be for this next generation.
Will Potter is an award-winning investigative journalist and TED Senior Fellow who exposes political repression and the erosion of civil liberties. He's been reporting on protest movements for more than 25 years. His new book is Little Red Barns, Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable. It's the result of a 10-year investigation on ag gag laws. They classify factory farm investigations as an act of domestic terrorism. He writes about the powerful forces working to obscure reality and suppress protest, and animal agriculture's role in accelerating climate collapse. You write about so many instances of activists who have decided to go to factory farms and take photographs and videos. And it was so interesting the way that you lay it all out. In the beginning, the media really grabbed this footage, especially when we saw a lot of journalists lose their jobs, a lot of media organizations cutting back. And so they relied on these activists for this footage. And they were almost hailed as heroes. And then the industry realized what was happening, and they cracked down very, very hard. Can you go through that and just tell us how that unfolded?
Yeah, as you mentioned, with my first book, Green is the New Red, I was trying to sound the alarm of how environmentalists and animal activists were being labeled as the FBI's top domestic terrorism threat. Civil disobedience was being labeled as terrorism, tree sits, protests, road blockades. And a lot of it was done in the name of going after the so-called radicals, right? Maybe people had broken a window or set an SUV or a bulldozer on fire or did some property destruction. What I saw immediately when that book was published in 2011 is with this rise of undercover investigations that were getting international media coverage, and like you said, Rose, really filling a void and a need in newsrooms that were struggling for investigative journalism, the industry immediately hit back, and there was no ramp-up period. It went straight from going after the so-called eco-terrorists and people that are going out at night and doing sabotage or civil disobedience, and instead going after people that were just taking photographs, people with legitimate above-ground nonprofits that were working with law enforcement, working with the press, being public about how they're operating and releasing their footage. And to me, it was just chilling to see how quickly that expanded. And I think that's a really important lesson for folks listening to this that applies to everything else we're talking about. Attacks on the margins always extend towards the mainstream. This is the lesson of authoritarianism historically. And we've seen this post 9/11. And I think what I've documented across my career is this steady and consistent creep, which really set the stage. Going after animal activists and journalists as terrorists set the stage for these attacks on immigrants and anti-fascists and the press that we're seeing right now.
And before we go to break, you have so many examples of the most horrific animal abuse. And in many cases, farmers, well, really, we can talk about this after the break. It's the farm workers that are usually held accountable and not the owners of these massive farms. And this is just getting a lot of attention because people do not like animal abuse. And after investigations, the industry got together and realized that they needed to shift the conversation. You write that in internal documents, private conferences, and publications, they talked about how to reframe the debate. They knew they had to change the narrative and fast, as the idyllic visage of the Little Red Barn was being replaced in the public's mind with industrialized animal cruelty. So they started to tell a new story. In this version, the villain was not the worker caught beating and sexually assaulting animals, nor was it the corporate exec who created the standard industry practices. It was the activist with a camera. In this new narrative, it was not the animals who were the victims. It was the farm owners. Can you talk more about that and how quickly it shifted?
And in particular, it shifted after a series of really damning investigations that led to international coverage, closure of slaughterhouses, the largest meat recall in U.S. history. I mean, these are tangible significant impacts on the industry that were not only shaping public opinion, but shaping how they do business. And so the reason they needed to shift that dialogue, and I think they did it quite brilliantly, is they deflected attention from the people that are actually doing the horrible things that were exposed. And many of those things eventually are able to be prosecuted under the law as well. So these are people exposing potentially illegal activity. And then the industry shifted the narrative to put the blame on this terrorist boogeyman of animal activism. And by doing that, it really just turned the entire discussion on its head. All of a sudden, almost overnight, you had multiple states debating legislation, calling this type of photography an act of terrorism. And the discussion was not about how we change those horrific practices, how we make this industry more sustainable. It was all about how farmers are under attack from animal activists. And that's really what set up the stage for this repression.
Will, do you think people know how much has changed with animal agriculture? You write that today, factory farming is how 99% of all animals are raised for food in the United States. Four companies operate about 75% of the world's corporate beef packing plants. Another four control 70% of pig slaughter. 40 years ago, most of the chicken sold came from 36 companies. Today, four firms control 99% of the global chicken breeding market. Do you think most people know how much this has changed?
I'm kind of split on my answer to that because I see both extremes. I think both that there's just nearly complete ignorance about how much has changed in this industry. I think a lot of us want to still think that this little red barn image of the farm still exists. And maybe we know about the industry changing, but we still think that that's possible. And maybe the egregious abuses that we've seen on video are kind of isolated or not the norm. And then at the same time, I meet people often who it's almost like we don't want to hear about some of the things I report in Little Red Barns because we know that the system is bad, right? It's this kind of like, oh, I can't look at this. I know, I've heard about it. That footage is terrible. So I guess I think both are true. I think as our culture, we have a general idea of like, okay, the food system is messed up. And maybe we've seen some headlines or even a video clip that we know the animals aren't treated well. But I don't think we know the scale of it, that this is the dominant, this is like you said, Rose, 99% of animals raised for food in the US are through this system. It is eradicating the little red barn, the small family farm, workers' rights, public health standards, environmental standards, animal welfare. I don't think we have a grasp on the scale of it. And frankly, I felt kind of jarred by that in the long research of this book of just how much has changed since the, let's say, the 1940s and 50s when this system started coming online.
In Little Red Barns, Will Potter writes, the number of farmers is steadily declining, but each farm is producing more animals on the same amount of space. Today, a single farm for broiler chickens, for example, can produce 500,000 birds every year. Will Potter is an award-winning investigative journalist who's out with a new book, Little Red Barns: Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable. It is a 10-year investigation on the powerful forces working to obscure reality and suppress protest, animal agriculture's role in accelerating climate collapse, and ag gag laws, which classify factory farm investigations as an act of domestic terrorism. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we're spending the hour with investigative journalist Will Potter, who's been reporting on protest movements for more than 25 years. He's out with a new book, Little Red Barns: Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable. Nearly 10 billion animals are raised, transported, and slaughtered every single year just in the United States without any meaningful government regulation or oversight on how farm animals are treated. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Thank you for
Hello.
holding.
Hi, thank you. I have two issues I want to ask you about. One has to do with the animal farming, and another has to do with politics. So I try to make this as quick as I can. Firstly, you know, I don't know what you can do about the beef industry in this country. I think that may be a dead issue. But I'm wondering about why even the state of California doesn't realize that human beings, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, human beings are the only species after they've been weaned that continues to drink milk, and that's cow's milk. So I don't know why that industry is even allowed to persist in the state of California, given the amount of land it takes, the amount of water that's used, the amount of waste that's produced. So that's one issue. The other one has to do with the legal and political side of this. You mentioned something about civil war. I think I would disagree with you on this. One, the right is much more armed than the left, but that's not, to me, the real big issue. It's the military. They're the people that you have to be worried about. Then you've already seen what they've been doing in these large cities. And I happened to listen to a program yesterday where they had somebody was interviewing an academic. And he said that, they can't be doing this kind of stuff if there isn't a lot of infrastructure already set in place for them to continue to do it and expand it. And he said trying to get rid of that infrastructure is not going to be easy. And then I just finished with one thing. He mentioned that there are academics who have left the United States, including the people that went to Spain. I'm sure he's aware of Jason Stanley. His wife moved to Canada. But Henry Giroux, who we may or may not know, was an academic who moved to Canada early on. He was an anti-fascist scholar, critical of Trump, critical of where the nation was going. And he said he left because he thought he was being targeted and he wanted to get out of the United States. And he finished up with really unbelievable comment. He said, the people in Germany who knew what was going on got out early. Okay, so, I don't know if he's got comments about any of that, but that may be where we're headed.
That's pretty scary, Greg. Thank you. Henry Giroux is tweeting, actually. He just has a piece about Trump and the criminalization of free speech. We should invite him on soon. Thank you. Will, do you want to address the second part of Greg's question and comment first?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I know it's difficult when we're talking about potential, where this is going, right? I mean, there is a healthy amount of trying to read the room and just making our best guesses. The reason I think we're heading in that direction, particularly about civil war, is a couple of reasons. One, Trump is already talking about a third term. I mean, he's making it very clear, and so are his supporters, that he has no intention of leaving office. So I think even if we have midterm elections, even assuming those elections are fair, we need to think about 2028. And if those elections continue and Trump loses, I don't think he's going to leave office voluntarily. So that's the kind of timeline or arc that I'm seeing of there's going to be a lot of steps along the way, but I think that is a confrontation that really can't be avoided. The issue of the military, I think, is a really important one when we're talking about fascists historically and how they consolidate and maintain power. That's kind of how I'm viewing ICE right now. I mean, we're seeing the buildup of arguably the largest private military force. And I say private in the sense of being under the direct control of the administration. I mean, it's not, there's at least some ostensible safeguards in place with the army and foreign forces. But what's being developed with ICE is this kind of mercenary force that they're just offering paychecks to whoever will take it to go out and crack heads and snatch people off the street. And that type of heavy investment in militarization, I think, is incredibly dangerous. When I'm seeing things like Henry Giroux moving early on, I'm thinking the same things, to be honest. I mentioned Hannah Arendt earlier, and I believe it was in The Origin of Totalitarianism. She talks about exactly this, that a lot of the folks in Berlin, in Nazi Germany, at the point where they finally realized, like, hey, we have to get out of here, we're not going to make it, it's too dangerous, was kind of too late. And so I don't really know what to do with that, to be honest. I'm struggling with that daily, this tension between, like, wanting to fight and bear witness and do what we can, but also trying to be strategic and smart. And I don't know. I think people are having to make some really difficult personal decisions about where to situate themselves to be safe as we continue this work.
And then, thank you, Greg. Greg's first question, he asks, why don't California politicians realize that human beings are the only species who drink milk?
Well, I think the short answer to that is anytime we talk about politics, we have to talk about money. And this industry is wielding its deep pockets. It lobbies, I talk about in Little Red Barns, its lobbying influence is comparable to that of the oil industry. It's doing this both federally and at the state level. It's lobbying for subsidies and reduced restrictions, reduced legal protections, reduced environmental restrictions, reduced access to information. I go into this all really in depth in the book. But I guess to answer your question, Greg, I think it's a mix of that. It's a mix of the money. And we can see how people are starting to realize that we are the only species that drinks milk. And I see that with coffee shops right now. The rise of like plant-based milk and the way that the industry is seeing that as such a threat. There's multiple initiatives at the state level to outlaw calling things like soy milk under some, concocted labeling lawsuit, because they're really trying to shut down the opposition. To me, all of this boils down to money and the industry trying to protect its profits, despite the fact it's not what consumers want. And it's not what's best for animals, our health, or the environment.
As you point out in Little Red Barns, Will, the people who bear the brunt of all of this tend to be low income, people of color, and immigrants. And according to the California Coast Keeper Alliance, the dairy industry in California is mainly concentrated in the Central Valley. 89% of the state's cows are there. 81% of the state's dairy farms are there. And that's where you've got low-income families, rural communities, and people of color. As the California Coast Keeper Alliance says, they bear the brunt of the industry's environmental degradation. Many of these residents rely on local groundwater resources for drinking water and daily use, yet their water is often contaminated and polluted with high levels of nitrates from the large amounts of improperly managed manure and wastewater generated by local dairy farms. Will, we could talk for hours about all of the experiences you write about in Little Red Barn when you visit factory farms, but I think the one that was, it was almost like we were there with you and it was just so disgusting, was the poop tour that you took in the Yakima Valley in Washington State. Can you tell us about this? And also, this statistic deserves more attention. According to the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, air pollution from factory farms kill 17,000 people a year. That is more than the deaths caused by coal plants.
And, I had been aware in my research for many years of statistics like that. And I've known about the discrepancy of how immigrant and people of color and low-income folks are disproportionately hurt. But like you said, there's something else about being out there in person that really made this real for me. And that happened in Yakima. I was doing drone investigations of environmental pollution of factory farms. And I had some problems. I lost a drone. I had to rearrange my plans on this trip. And so I met up with a longtime resident named Helen, who had seen her community change over these decades. And she took me out on what she called this poop tour. And I will never forget. I've seen so much horrific footage. I've been on factory farms. I've been on slaughterhouses repeatedly. I've been on the kill floors. Seeing this community through her eyes just changed me. There were points where we couldn't drive down certain roads because there was so much feces from the dairy farms clogging the roads. She was telling me stories about the postal service not being able to deliver mail. She took me through her home and she had all the windows closed and she was sweeping up dead black flies and apologizing because this is what her life is like now. She was spraying like some cheap perfume to try to mask the scent, but it's just impossible to escape. And I talk about in Little Red Barns, it hit me viscerally, in part because I've struggled with asthma and COPD my whole life. And I'd been in bad areas, and Helen warned me that I was going to get sick from this poop tour. And sure enough, I was for weeks. I ended up having to go on steroids to get this crud out of my lungs. Mm-hmm. But it's difficult to breathe. And part of it is because something we haven't talked about is the way these factory farms work. They create so much waste, and the waste has to go someplace. Now, in the Little Red Barn image of the farm, the cows poop on the grass, it goes into the earth, it grows more crops, it's a natural system. On factory farms, they're often on concrete, and they take all of this waste, which is sometimes as much as a U.S. city of human beings, that much feces, and they put it in these giant pits that they call waste lagoons, and then they spray that waste from the pits in industrial sprinkler systems, so it becomes airborne. And that's not just feces that's becoming airborne. That's all the antibiotics and hormones and all the other things that are in that waste and that pool that are now entering the air. And that's why you have asthma rates and death by air pollution and environmental impacts like water quality, people not being able to drink the well water. It's all related to the system where, as Helen showed me in the poop tour, it is just so much waste and feces that it has nowhere else to go.
And you write that this is a relatively new practice in the industry, but it's caught on quickly. In North Carolina, 95% of hog pig farms spray waste.
And it's hard to really bring this to life to folks of just how overwhelming this is, because you can go through these communities, and it took the drone for me to see the scale of these waste lagoons, which sometimes could be like as big as a football field, but then to see these sprinklers with just this brown sludge being pumped out onto the fields. Sometimes the farmers spray too much, and this can burn out their entire cropland, and then they have to let that land sit because it's not usable. So you can just imagine that what that's doing to our bodies. Helen would joke about this, she called it the poo flu. You know, she has these scientists and people from the United Nations and experts and all kinds of journalists that she meets with all the time. And she teased me that, you know, I might think I'm a hardcore investigative journalist, but I'm going to get this poo flu. Because we're not used to it. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. So it just left me really disoriented from the scale. I mean, Helen's community is just one town, and there's so many of these across the U.S., and now they're spreading globally. To give you just a taste of that, in China, the newest trend is to take U.S.-style factory farming and to turn those North Carolina farms, those hog farms, into skyscrapers, where you have 20 stories of pigs and their waste. And that's the kind of just truly dystopian future that we're entering right now with our food system.
I remember reading about that. I just looked it up. It's actually a 26-story pig skyscraper ready to slaughter 1 million pigs every year. Yeah, that's out of a movie.
It is. And I think I joke about this all the time, but I feel like if a lot of these things appeared in a film, we would think it's kind of overwritten, right? It's too much. It's too absurd. And I think sometimes it is defying belief. And I think a lot of folks, kind of what you were saying at the start of the show, Rose, were struggling to process it because it's just like, how is this allowed to continue? And the answer to that is the influence of corporations on our political system.
Will, we have a couple emails from listeners who would like you to talk about dairy companies that say that they're humane certified.
You know, I go in depth into all of these terms in the book in Little Red Barns, but I think the most important thing for people to know is that all of these labeling and advertising processes that the industry has come up with really lack teeth. They lack enforcement mechanisms. Now, there's really good activism groups and nonprofits that are trying to oversee this and see that the labeling is being applied correctly. There's been a bunch of lawsuits. But the big takeaway is I think consumers need to have an incredibly healthy amount of skepticism when they're seeing different labeling schemes, often accompanied by that little red barn on the product label. Because the industry has realized that consumers actually want to do the right thing. Like, I don't think anyone wants to be supporting factory farms. We want to be making smarter choices that are better for the planet and for animals and for our communities. And that's being manipulated by advertising and a lot of these labeling schemes. The truth is there really isn't an enforcement mechanism for a lot of these efforts calling everything from cage-free to humane, green-certified, and things like that.
We're speaking with Will Potter, author of Little Red Barns, Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable. You write about the factory farm workers. You say we need to remember the identity of typical factory farm workers. The people who work on factory farms are predominantly immigrants, non-native English speakers. In many cases, they're undocumented. They don't have access to lawyers or the money to pay them. Agriculture is one of the most dangerous industries for these workers. The injury rate is 40% higher than that of other jobs. In many cases, the kill rates are going up. Slaughter line speeds for poultry can reach 175 birds per minute. That's 3 birds a second. And workers have said that they have to wear diapers because they don't have time to go to the bathroom. This is according to an Oxfam report. So we'll have to have you back, Will, but what are your thoughts about the workers? I mean, their lives are at risk here. The farmers, we still don't, so many people still don't know what is a small farm? What is a big farm? How, what percentage of land is owned by a small farmer and a large farmer?
And I think that's at the heart of a lot of this confusion that the industry is taking advantage of. Hmm. I will say about workers, the one thing I've that's become very clear to me, I've done a lot of reporting on prisons as well as it relates to terrorism and national security. I've visited a lot of prisons and kind of experimental prison units. And I will say that prison towns are an awful lot like farm towns in the sense that I don't think anybody really wants to be a CEO at a prison, or I don't think people really want to go work at the factory farm. These are trapped communities that are really beholden to that industry. It's an industry town, whether it's the prison or the factory farm. And I say that because I think we need to keep that in mind. It's tempting when we see some of this horrific footage, and I see the comments on YouTube or on social media. It elicits a lot of rage, right? And it's tempting to just firmly direct that rage at the worker, whether the one shown on camera or just the workers writ large. And this project has made me see some the complexity in this, in that it's possible to not excuse what's caught on video, while at the same time recognizing that the workers are lacking any power in this situation as well. Like you said, they're overwhelmingly immigrants, not native English speakers. They don't have access to attorneys. So when things like these ag gag laws are being passed and they're putting a burden on workers to turn over video footage immediately to police, that's not a fair burden on these workers. And it goes even further than that because Black farmers in particular have been hit relentlessly in this consolidation. They've been kind of left out to dry even more than most. So I think we have to keep that lens of realizing that like this entire system is just eating up anything that it comes in contact with. And I hope that makes us see some nuance here, because at the end of the day, this rhetoric that the industry uses about family farms is not regulated. The USDA describes a family farm just by its ownership structure. It has nothing to do with the size of the farm. So if you hear someone say, oh, we're a factory farm, but we're a family farm. That's kind of like Walmart saying it's a family business because it's owned by the Waltons. It doesn't mean anything.
Well, we'll have to have you back, Will, because we have a number of emails from people who would like to know more about this, the difference between a factory farm and a family farm, and how they should be thinking about this and how they can get access to that information. Will Potter is an award-winning investigative journalist. His new book is Little Red Barns, Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us, Will.
Thank you so much, Rosa. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rosa Aguilar. It's your call.